Hey folks, thanks for tuning into Off Camera. And I'm assuming if you're listening to this, or if you're a citizen on planet Earth, you've also shopped at Amazon. Well, here's a great way to shop at Amazon while supporting the show as well. Instead of going directly to them, go to wolfpop.com/Amazon. That'll take you to the same Amazon you know and love with the same one-day shipping and the same great prices, but you'll be supporting the show as well. So check it out, and thanks for listening. Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with Will Ferrell. Just mention Will Ferrell's name or glance at a picture of him, and chances are you're already smiling. But the really funny thing is that it's not necessarily because his best-known characters are so gosh darn lovable. You see, Ferrell never bought the conventional movie truism that comedic leads have to be likable, and he went on to prove it, perhaps most pointedly, with the iconic Ron Burgundy. In fact, he doesn't even think comedy has to be particularly funny to be hysterical. While working a number of regular jobs, like valet and bank teller, Ferrell did stand-up in small comedy clubs, clinging to his father's surprisingly helpful advice that his ever making it would be a long shot. It was just that take-it-or-leave-it approach that allowed him to pursue his unique comedic style, free from the angst that might have otherwise crushed it. It might also explain a small sadistic streak that underlies his performances. If you don't like what he's doing, sit back and enjoy it anyway, or else. In my chat with Will, he describes his stomach-churning, knee-buckling Saturday Night Live audition, and the even more daunting experience of joining the legendary show at one of its lowest points. He also shares his writing process, stories behind some of his best-loved impersonations, and his long and sometimes perplexing feature film resume. His success and work in projects as diverse as Elf and Stranger Than Fiction illustrate the rare genius of someone who can make the ridiculously absurd not only believable, but sympathetic. Chalk it up to talent or unquestioning commitment to any role he takes on, but not to hard work. Ferrell's a firm believer in not overthinking the work or worrying too much about whether his projects succeed, as long as he's having fun along the way. He may not be cerebral, but trust me, he's brilliant. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Will Ferrell.
Hi, Sam.
Thank you very much for doing this.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
No, it's a great honor. And when you told me you'd actually seen the show, I thought, well, we should get him on. That doesn't happen very often.
I'm a fan.
Well,
I'm a fan.
I appreciate it. And I've been a fan of yours a long time, and we've worked together a lot.
Right.
And I was going through some of the old shoots to kind of prepare for this.
Right.
And I think the first time I photographed you, you were on a miniature pony.
That's right.
Yeah, and you've been naked in a lot of the shoots, too.
A couple of the shoots.
Yeah, which brings up a lot of questions.
Right.
Do you have moments where you say, later, maybe reflecting back, you know, maybe I crossed a line there? Or do you always kind of feel like you can't go far enough?
You know, I mean, there's there's definitely things I know I've been asked to do that I thought, no, that's too much. But I have to honestly say, I don't think it came from the response of it's too much as it was. I just didn't think it was funny.
Right.
And the times that maybe I did cross the line, I always find out later because I don't realize I'm doing it in the moment. You know, I used to do Harry Carey, the Chicago Cubs announcer, on Saturday Night Live, and which was really fascinating because, you know, it worked obviously for people who had grown up listening to Chicago Cubs games and White Sox games, but it also worked for people who had no idea who he was. So I would have people come up to me and say, "Oh, I love that mad scientist character you do." I'm like, "Mad scientist? I don't do a mad scientist character." You're like, "Yeah, the guy with the glasses and the crazy white hair."
Right.
Like, I'm like, "Oh, Harry Carey." He's like, "Yeah, I don't know, but it's so funny." Anyway, but I was doing the first year of the ESPYs.
Right.
Norm Macdonald was the host. Big Radio City Music Hall. And a bunch of the SNL writers are writing the show, and they ask if I'll come and do Harry Carey for the you bring me out in the middle of the show, and I'm just going to be confused and not know where I'm at. You know, I think I'm at the, you know, the Grammys, or and I'm and then I'm and then I systematically go and make fun of athletes.
Right.
Well, they wrote a joke for me commenting, and John Elway sitting, and they made a comment about John Elway's, because John Elway has a bit of a toothy smile.
Yeah.
And I made a comment as Harry, and apparently I got the feedback that he was very unhappy, that it was just not cool. And from that moment on, apparently in all the ESPY meetings for 10 years after that, they were like, no more Will Ferrell, Harry Carey moments. We have to make sure we don't have that. So for everyone who thought it was funny, there were a lot of athletes who were offended and upset. But once again, in the heat of battle, I had no idea
right.
I was doing that. But that's still relatively benign. It's not...
Right.
It's not a, you know, something racially insensitive or, you know, this, that, and the other.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I think it's one of those things where you always seem to use your body as a vessel for comedy, and you made that decision early on.
Yeah,
You're just going to do that, and I guess once you go there, it's probably freeing in some
ways. Another thing too, we used to we'd get letters on Saturday Night Live saying, "Hey, don't you know, that was really mean what you guys did about this topic or that topic or the portrayal of this person," but we were always taking what was given to us, so. I think part two, second answer to your question is, I think it's people's job in comedy to kind of push that boundary and walk right up to that line.
So, well, like a guy like Andy Kaufman, I think.
Of course,
But there is sort of a, you can sort of go on that historical element. Like if you're an absurdist by nature, which sure. I kind of think that a lot of your humor is like Andy Kaufman.
Bit, yeah,
is he one of your sort of heroes?
Loved him. Yeah. You know, I remember watching Andy Kaufman once again on the early Saturday Night Lives, mm-hmm. and you know when he played the Mighty Mouse records, and half of my brain too young to really understand what was happening, uh-huh. the other half of my brain going, "Oh, there's no point to this really. He's just messing with the audience, and still getting laughs." And I always loved that. You know, ultimately you are trying to get laughs, but there is an element to a lot of the things I've done that are messing with people to an extent. Yeah.
Yeah. I do think that there's something funny in that sort of, it's not playing for the joke or for the punchline, but it's just oddly messing with people. Because you said once, I think I read a quote where you said, there's part of you that doesn't care if a sketch bombs. Like there's part of you that gets a twisted. What did you mean by that?
We would, I think some of the hardest laughs we ever had on the show was to go back and look at the previous week's show, but not at the sketches that worked really well, but at the ones that were cut during dress rehearsal that got nary a peep.
And, oh, really?
And where most people's instincts would be halfway through a sketch like, this is not going well. Let's just speed it up and get through it. I had this, I don't know what it is, this mechanism within me that had this reaction to, okay, audience, you're not laughing. I'm gonna make this 4-minute sketch into 7 minutes. You're gonna have to sit through it twice as long. If you hate it that much, I'm gonna force you to sit. Then I would just slow the sketch down, take my time. And I don't know what, that's for no one's benefit really. But I wasn't afraid of doing that, and there was a sketch I wrote that worked really great at the table and got into the show, and I was a guy who looked exactly like Gabe Kaplan from Welcome Back, Kotter.
Yeah,
and I cultivated my look, and I worked at an insurance company, and it was the day that he had come in to sign some papers, and no one bothered to get me, and I was in the bathroom, and I walked into the break room, and everyone's talking about, God, he was such a nice guy, he was so funny. I'm like, who are you guys talking about? Oh, Gabe Kaplan was here, and I look exactly like him. They're like, what do you mean? Why didn't anyone get me? Are you kidding me? Like, and anyway, it got one of the smallest laughs I've ever heard. It got nothing, and then there was one little titter at the end. But we would watch those sketches and just howl at how the pain and the misery of going through that. And for some reason, that made us laugh harder than anything that worked.
So you would almost like watch game film.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then apparently I'd heard like some of the the cast that came after, like Andy Samberg and Sudeikis and those guys, have told me they pulled that sketch. We heard about that sketch that went so horribly wrong, and we actually watched that. And then they started watching some of the sketches that bombed. So it became like a cult thing to do within the show.
Where do you think that came from? That you would want to drag something out like that if it wasn't working? Like, that takes confidence, I think.
Yeah, I think it was just an internal test, you know, that you obviously, comedy is such an interesting thing, and I'm sure you've probably gathered this from all the people in comedy you've talked to, but it's such a weird combination of, you have to be supremely confident, but not overconfident. You never really know if anything's going to work, but yet you have to be willing to try it. And so when things went bad, it was almost like a ninja warrior thing to, like, okay, you wrote this, you thought of this, you got to stick with it and see it till its end. Don't bail on it, because this is how it's sometimes going to go. And for some reason, that's the way I reacted. I'm banking on the fact that you're ultimately going to find it funny. But if you don't, I'm sorry. I'm just going to punish you with it. So, yeah.
I watched a whole reel of your bloopers.
Okay.
I mean, YouTube's amazing. You can just find things you didn't plan on finding.
The reel of my bloopers, yes.
And it's this blooper reel, and I noticed in a lot of them, it seemed like your intention was to get your co-stars to laugh.
Yeah.
I'm remembering an Eastbound and Down thing where Danny McBride's there, and yeah, I think it's the plums.
Right.
And from the bloopers, to me, I'm looking at, you know, your whole goal there is to see if you can get these guys to break character. Yeah. Is that the goal sometimes?
That started at Saturday Night Live once, you know, once you kind of break through the first 2 years, the fear of doing that show, and then you reach a comfort level and it becomes like your home gym, so to speak.
Right.
And then once you kind of get to that level, then it became a whole nother thing to try to mess with the cast. If I wouldn't do it in an obnoxious way, and I never would do it to sabotage a sketch, but there became moments where the characters that Rachel Dratch and I had come up with, where were these professors who are just the people you don't want to meet on a vacation,
right.
Who are overly expressive and they're about their relationship, and it's a scene with Jimmy Fallon and Drew Barrymore where we're in a hot tub, and I don't know why, I could tell Jimmy was barely hanging on from the beginning, but then for some reason I just had the urge that underneath the water just to keep touching his leg.
Oh, you
and,
did?
Yeah, and just keep squeezing. and but it was kind of within character too, you know, like, and but that just became something that if it was the right moment, you know, you can't do it too many times. It just made us closer as a cast, and
right.
it also. I think reminded us and the audience that it's a live television show.
Is it sort of at that point, it's just like, is it a badge of honor to get them to laugh?
Totally, yeah, yeah. And it's also why you're doing it in the first place.
When you brought out Funny or Die, I think one of the first sketches was The Landlord.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
And to me, I watched that and I got the sense that it was like, oh, you got the idea, you shot it, bam, bam. Like, it looked like it came together and was done very quickly. And, like, it had that same sort of energy. And it made me wonder if you, if you sort of tend to try to replicate or if you miss the live comedy environment of having that sort of instant feedback from an audience.
Once you kind of, for me at least, once I leave one thing and move on to the next, I don't tend to look back. So when I left SNL, I was happy to go, but for all the right reasons. And but there are times where you wake up and you're like, oh, this would be great to do in front of an audience, and it would only really work in front of an audience. But that, but the landlord sketch is a prime example of, we just, okay, we started this website, now we need things to put on the website.
Oh, so you didn't have the things first?
No,
you just started the
not
website
at all.
First.
It happened, and we're like, oh shoot, okay. And Adam and I started talking. We're like, God, we should. Okay, we got to think of something to put on the site. And he had said, oh, you know, his daughter was 2 at the time, and he's like, and she's super verbal, and he's like, you know, I have this one idea where maybe Pearl is like this nasty landlord. And I said, yeah, okay. Yeah, that sounds good. When he come over, I think he literally came over. My son Magnus was having his 3-year-old birthday party, and in the middle of the birthday party, we just ran over and shot it.
So it was that quick?
In an hour, yeah. And got the setup, got my coverage, got her coverage, gave her all the little lines to say, and then, and we were like, yeah, that'll work, right?
And it was just like, that's something we could throw
That's something there. We can throw up there, and right. that'll be at least, at least we're on the site, and it's, yeah, it's still so funny to see the impact that it had, and
What, were you surprised when it started getting?
We were blown away, the technical guys on the site, it was closing down all the servers, and the site within that first week crashed multiple times because we didn't have enough space for, you know, all the traffic that was coming through, and we're just laughing. We're just going, really, this little landlord video? And then upon second glance, I kind of go, no, that actually is really funny. It came out pretty good.
Yeah, I mean,
and I guess we really are funny. Professionals who know what we're doing.
Yeah.
The other great landlord moment is being invited to the White House for the White House Christmas party. And this is the one that they have a bunch of Christmas parties throughout the
right.
season. But this is the one that's only for White House staff and family. And they'd asked if I would come, and they have entertainment. They want to know would I come and read the Grinch. And I'm like, sure. But here's this room of, like, you know, the senior staff. And so we're seated with the First Lady.
Right.
And so my wife Viv and I were, you know, sitting next to Michelle Obama, who's the most composed, kind of natural person you're ever going to come around, you know. And she's like, I just have to tell you, that landlord video, oh, my gosh. My staff showed me that video. Where's my money, bitch? She just goes into the impersonation. And I was like, you have made my day. You've made, like, my century, my decade. I have to tell Adam about this. But that was, like, that was the moment where I was like, oh, this has had a cultural impact somehow, in a way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, folks. I hope you're enjoying the conversation, and we'll get right back to it. But I want to tell you about this new service called Animoto. You know, in today's digital world, video is no longer an option, but a necessity to market your business. Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are all expanding their video features to help you stand out from the crowd. But the biggest challenge for business owners is the time and cost of traditional video creation. Animoto wants to help you solve this problem. Animoto is a drag-and-drop video builder that gives you everything you need to produce professional videos in minutes. You don't need any editing experience. You can blend video clips and photos seamlessly into one video without any extra work. With an Animoto account, you can create as many HD videos as you'd like. And they have a large library of commercially licensed music from Triple Scoop to choose from, saving you the hassle of copyright issues. Animoto makes it easy to post and share your videos on your website, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and email. Animoto hosts your videos in the cloud for easy viewing by you and your customers. And you can try Animoto out for free. So what are you waiting for? Join thousands of business owners who are using Animoto to stand out from the crowd. And best of all, you can support the show.
Go to animoto.com/offcamera and use the promo code offcamera to get 15% off a pro account. So check it out and then send me your video. No, don't do that. Unless it's cats. I love cat videos. And now let's get back to the show.
When did you first know that you could make people laugh? Like, do you remember going like, oh, this works and I enjoy doing this? Or?
You know, it was always something that I could kind of fall back on on the playground at school. I mean, I do remember at a really early age being funny with my friends and, you know, because every kid has social anxiety. You know, when you're first starting school or meeting people or this and that.
That was just me.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah. I somehow could make my friends laugh. And
but did you need it or did you just?
But I enjoyed it. But I didn't. That's where I'm a bit of a weirdo. It's not like I, because most of the stories were I hated school, I was disinterested, I was the obnoxious class clown. I was none of those. I loved school. I was a good student. So I was very conscientious, and I could make my teachers laugh and stuff. But then when they said, you know what, take a break, I'm like, you got it. I'll just chill out.
Yeah.
Just tell me when you want me to ramp it up again.
Yeah. If the lesson gets a little boring, just call me. I'll warm them up for you.
One of the moments, though, for me was in high school when we were doing, I had a friend who was our class president who was trying to think of a campaign to sell senior class t-shirts to raise money so that we could go to Disneyland at the end of the year, whatever it was. And he had me and my friend Bart write little sketches that we would do voices on the morning announcements and do character. And one night I spent 4 hours writing a little sketch, revising it, rewriting it. But I thought I'd spent 20 minutes.
Oh, really?
And I looked at the watch. I'm like, okay, I better get back to my homework. Well, it was midnight and I'd started at 8 o'clock. And I thought, oh, don't forget this feeling that this does not feel like work. This feels like I could do this for another 4 hours. And I loved the idea of changing a line and figuring out how to word a joke differently. And so I always held on to how good that felt and how that, you know, once again, that did not feel arduous to me in any sort of way. And then it helps when you read it the next day and it works and students are coming up and like, that was hilarious. And even teachers would, this became this thing. We're like, when are you guys going to do another morning announcement? Those things are hilarious.
Oh, really?
And we started performing at assemblies. So that was like kind of my first taste of, this is pretty fun. But I wasn't confident enough or I guess adventurous enough to say, well, this is what I'm doing. You know, I still went to college, still was hanging on to the thought that I was gonna, you know, not have a life in entertainment because I'd seen how, you know, how tough it was with, you know, my dad's a musician and watching him kind of go in and out of jobs. And so I thought, oh, I'll be a sportscaster. So I studied sports journalism and I was like, that's kind of, I love sports and that's kind of entertainment. That's like a good, that's like a real job that's also entertainment related. But then I graduated college and then that's when it was still, I still had this thing of like, I gotta try comedy. I don't know what that means, but I gotta try it.
So, I mean, you graduated with a degree in journalism, right? So was it hard for you to sort of, you know, let that go and decide to go some other way?
No, well, here's what happened is it's not like, you know, as is the case with most things in life, it wasn't as if I graduated with this degree and
a job was waiting for
exactly,
you.
Exactly. Television stations were calling going,
we got to get this guy.
He's amazing. and I saw, okay, this is going to take some time. I'm going to have to figure out how to get a, you know, my tape together. And so I started working at a cable news station. Of course, I graduated from college. I moved right back home.
Yeah. How was that? Was that sort of like...
I was lucky. I mean, I had an understanding mother who was like, you could, you know what, we'll just treat this as your graduate school. You know, as long as you have a, some sort of job to pay for your gas money, I'll let you live at home, but you got to kind of keep doing stuff, you know, keep pushing the rock forward. So I started working at a local news station, and I was doing okay. I was going out and getting little stories, and I would anchor the news occasionally.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was actually doing it. But the jobs were Yuma, Arizona, to start out, you know.
Right.
Flagstaff or San Bernardino, you know, all these small markets. You know, you got to start at the small markets. I thought, wow, everyone talks about how hard comedy is. This is just as hard on a different level. And yet I can't. I'm still thinking about the comedy thing. So then while I was doing that, I said, hey, I'm gonna try doing my first time at an open mic. And actually I found a I found a stand-up comedy workshop in a junior college extension course. And the thing that I noticed about it was it ends in a performance at the Golden Bear in Huntington Beach, legendary Golden
Bear.
And which is where it's so funny, my dad used to play music there with like the Righteous Brothers and people like that. So kind of coming full circle in a weird way. And I thought, oh, you know what? This will force me, because I had gone, even in high school, I'd gone to the Irvine Improv and places like that and sat in the back of the room at an open mic and thought, oh, okay, I'm gonna, no. And just spend a whole night in the back of the room, too scared to go up there and watching other comics and going, oh, I think I'm just as funny as that guy. Oh no, those last three, they were amazing. They were great. And I could never get up the nerve to actually take the plunge. So I signed up for this course and it ended in this performance and it went really well. And then I was doing Groundlings classes and
right.
So all of that meshed from that point. I knew I was jettisoning the journalism thing.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I think that's such an amazing time for a kid, like when they find what they want to do. And did you feel like this is something that you're going to give yourself a time limit to do and to see if it works?
Or that was,
like, were you serious about it?
I was still very realistic in the sense that what if this doesn't work? Because there were plenty of nights that I'd gone out and done stand-up, you know, because this we're talking like early 90s where, you know, that was the huge explosion on cable with half-hour comedy hour on MTV.
Comic Relief.
A&E's Night at the Improv.
Yeah.
Because everyone forgets outside of that, the only place you could see a comedian was on The Tonight Show.
Right.
So this was this massive proliferation of stand-up comedy. So growing up in Orange County, every kind of local restaurant was starting to have a comedy night. And so I was going up at, you know, the Cannery in Newport Beach and all these local places and getting up there. And I would come back home and my mom would be like, how did it go? And I was like, thank God I have a college degree.
Really?
Yeah. So I had this thing in the back of my mind, like, okay, just give it a shot. And and I actually sat down and had lunch with my father, who's been in the music business for now 40 years. And I said, so Dad, I think I'm gonna give this a shot. I don't know what that means exactly, but I'm gonna try to get into comedy. And any words of advice? And he said, you know, because he'd seen me do stuff enough times, like if it was only about talent, I wouldn't worry about you because you really have some talent. But just know there's so much luck involved, and that if you go down this road and it's starting to feel, you know, like you don't, you're not getting anywhere. And if you ever want to quit, it's okay to quit. Just do something else. And for some reason, it's like the anti-pep talk.
Yeah.
For some reason, that took the pressure off of...
Because you saying it was out of your hands. It's like one in a million if
exactly.
you make it. And
so I just approached it with, like, this is probably not going to happen. So I might as well just have a blast. And but because I gave myself that break internally, I think it unbeknownst to me, opened all these doors... because people could read that I was so free with what I was doing, so
they could feel that.
Yeah.
I think that is you've described exactly what it is. Because when you want something so bad, it sometimes it gets in the way. That very desire gets in the way.
If you're holding the bat so tight that it's turning to sawdust in your hands, the bat'll disintegrate.
Right.
You have to, you know.
You did then allow yourself to get serious and not worry about like. Did you worry like, oh, I'm going to pursue this comedy thing and then I'm going to, the fallback is going to be on hold and maybe I won't be able to go back to it? No,
I think I honestly was like, I'll figure something out. I can always be a substitute teacher or something.
And how were you supporting yourself during this time?
I had some really good jobs. I was a valet.
Oh yeah,
Valley Parker. Yeah, I was a bank teller.
Really?
I somehow
that's stressful.
Survived all these jobs where, you know, I avoided waiting tables because I knew I'm not a good multitasker. I knew I wouldn't survive in that world. So I somehow survived this myriad of office jobs, and thank God Saturday Night Live came to see me at the Groundlings and.
God, it's like you want videotape of some of those moments to look back.
Yeah.
Do you remember your stand-up routine pre-Groundlings even when you were doing open mics? Do you remember any standout jokes?
I remember, my whole opening was a Star Trek-based opening where I would say, hello, how's everyone doing tonight? My name's Will Ferrell. Great to be here. And some of you probably don't know this. Some of you might know this, but some of you probably don't know this, that I was the original vocalist to the theme to Star Trek. And for anyone who used to watch the Star Trek shows, it has that famous, that song where it's like this woman's voice that's like, oh, and I would sing the entire song. And that would kind of get a laugh. A weird smattering of applause.
So how long was that?
It was literally this long. So I would that's what I would do. And depending on how drunk the crowd was, I was either off to a great start or either miserable. And I think the thing I would say after is like, thank you much. The reason why I can sing that is because I don't have any testicles. I'm like a Ken doll. I'm smooth. I'm kind of smooth down there. It's like a weird bump type of thing. So that was the start of my.
But see, right there, I see beginnings of you, because it's not just the testicles. That would be the joke.
Right.
But then to go into the smoothness.
Yes.
So, okay. Yeah. So I was reading about, and you've told this story before, so I don't want you to, you know, have to belabor it. But
right.
But I was kind of fascinated with, you described in one interview a moment that occurred right before you had to go on stage and give an audition. And You're on the floor. You're on the eighth floor,
for
Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And you said that you're standing right behind the stage door, and you've got all these portraits of the great Saturday Night Live titans. You know,
yes.
Belushi and Aykroyd. And
right.
You say you're trying not to vomit.
Yeah.
And I just wondered what that, you know, that like of all the things you're talking about, that's the pinnacle of anxiety,
totally.
Right?
Totally.
Yeah.
That's one of those moments where you I mean, I don't know if you've ever literally been weak in the knees. I don't know if you've ever experienced the feeling of being weak in the knees, but I felt weak in the knee. And I thought that was just a weird phrase. I didn't think it actually physically
happened.
Someone
made that up.
Yeah. But I literally felt like my knees were going to buckle. You're that nervous.
Really?
And it's as if you're a paratrooper, you know, about to jump out the plane. And you're trying to remember what you're going to do. You're just pacing. You're hearing the person on stage doing their audition, so you're trying to block that out. And then the doors just open, and they're like, "Well, yeah, come on." And it's like, "Okay, I just have to do this now." And it was so nerve-wracking and such a moment of having your back up against the wall that I passed the threshold, and then I just got really relaxed.
Well,
because I'm like, there's nothing to lose. I mean, here I am, so might as well just.
But I'm sure some people would buckle in that.
Oh yeah, like, yeah.
I'm sure some people did.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And just.
It's funny to talk about, you know, to talk to Forte or to talk to Jason Sudeikis or any of us who've been through that experience. Everyone has had a different, because Lauren doesn't do it in a set way. He mixed it up from year to year. And the year I happened to do it, it was on stage there at 8H, Studio 8H, where they do the show. So we had one audition, 5 to 8 minutes long.
Uh-huh.
And they give you these cryptic parameters, you know, a character of your choice, a celebrity impersonation if you have one, and a political impersonation if you have one. And if you don't have any of it, just funny. Just make it funny. So you're like, okay. So I made it through. There was a group of us from the Groundlings who'd been called out to LA to do it. And the word on the street was that the Groundlings had all done really well. And that there probably was going to be a callback. And so I got the call. And like, you're coming back, and this time it's going to be over 2 days. Lauren wants to meet you one day, and then you have the audition the next day. So that's when I walked into Lauren's office, and he's like, "So what are you going to do?" And I kind of went through, because the rule in TV, and this is the only time, it's not like I'd been doing a ton of TV auditions up until that point, but the rule when you're testing for network television is to do exactly what you did throughout the process. Just kind of keep it consistent, because that's what got you there.
Right.
So in TV, when you're testing for something, the conventional wisdom is to kind of consistently do the same thing with your character or whatever. So that was my game plan. I was going to kind of do the same audition that I had done the first time. I was going to add something different. I think I was going to try to do Bill Clinton as an impersonation, because I knew they're going to need someone to play the president. And little did I know, Daryl Hammond is auditioning at the same time, like one of the greatest impersonators of all time. But so I sit down with Lauren and I go through, and he's like, "No, I wouldn't do that. I would change that too." And he goes through the list. I said, "Okay, so just so I'm clear, should I just throw everything out?" And he's like, "Well, I just want." And in hindsight, what he was doing was actually really smart. He was forcing me to just come up with new stuff, new shades, new moves, so to speak, so that everyone back at the network could see that I could do other things. So, but he kind of just didn't say that. He kind of had a roundabout way of,
right.
But he, this get off the shed character yelling at these kids to get off the shed. He's like, "No, keep that. So then I'm up till 2 a.m. redoing a brand new audition in my head. And
I mean, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
Like you probably prepared for weeks, and then you.
I sat with the people, you know, Marcy Klein, who was in the talent office. She's like, "So how did it go?" And I'm like, "Well, he kind of told me to change everything." And she's like, "Okay. What can I do to help?" She was really helpful, and she moved my, she was like, "Would you want me to move you later in the day?" And I'm like, that would be great. And so it gave me some more time to just, because you're just alone in a hotel room talking to yourself.
Oh, God.
Doing character. Yeah. Like, well, maybe I'll do this guy. Okay. But it's not like I was sitting there writing it. So there I was that next day, just by the seat of my pants, doing three or four different things that I hadn't planned on doing. And I walked out of the studio going, I blew it. It's done. I didn't.
Really?
Yeah. As good as I felt about the first time, the second time I was like, oh, no, that's it.
Because you had no feedback either. You hadn't tried it out. Or,
yeah.
Because you did. I watched it. Someone has an actual tape of the audition.
Yeah.
And it was you playing with cat toys.
Yeah.
But I'm that thinking
that was probably like, that was the biggest sinking moment, because, you know, at that, the way the auditions were done, it was just an empty studio.
Right.
And there was no one in the room to laugh. But it was purposely done that way to create the pressure of live television. So here I am lying around with cat toys, playing with cat toys on the stage where the host for Saturday Night Live delivers the monologue every week. I was like, oh, this is the end. This is...
Now, the night before, were you running out to Walgreens and buying cat toys? Like,
I think I must have. Because, yeah, you had to kind of bring your own props. So, yeah, it was... and then I met my one friend who lived in New York at the time. I said, why don't we meet for a beer? Because I'm either going to feel really good and let's have a beer, or I'm going to feel horrible and let's have a beer.
Pretty much proving that beer goes with anything.
or we're going to be doing shots. Because I'm so... And we stayed out till 3 a.m. And he's like, well... I don't know if that, and then I started going through the characters I did. He's like, well, that sounds pretty funny, and this sounds pretty funny. I'm like, well, maybe I did better than I thought, you know. But you just have no idea.
Yeah, gosh.
Obviously.
I think the year before you got on, it hadn't been a great year for Saturday Night Live, right? And there were a lot of new people.
It was a ton of new people. Yeah, I think it was 7 or 8 brand new cast members and an entire new writing staff. Which, oddly enough, once again, was a gift.
How's that?
Because it was one for all and all for one.
So it took individual pressure off.
Right. Because the audience at home didn't know us. The writers, we all didn't know each other, but we kind of had to band together. And, you know, in the... like a Little Rascals movie, put on a show.
Right.
And the show was either going to be canceled with us or on to the next thing. And it was great. It was great. Everyone pulled for each other. And 'cause that was not necessarily the reputation of Saturday Night Live up to that point.
There was factions of...
all that stuff. And we just didn't have that. And it was just... also, too, it was the first job for so many of us. So you're living in New York, and you're on the show that you dreamed about, and here we are, and it's our job to try to save it. So instead of that feeling intimidating, it just was so exciting, and Lauren kind of had to just trust us with our whatever our tastes were.
Wow.
Yeah.
And did you feel at all, being from Southern California, like an outsider?
The only person I really knew who was hired was Sherry O'Terry.
Okay.
From the Groundlings. Chris Kattan was hired later that year, but... So I knew Sherry and I knew each other, and that's really it. But otherwise, there was a big click from Second City. There was a click from, you know, The Lampoon. There was all these little clicks, and everyone's doing their bits, and I was like, I didn't know what to do with myself, and it really wasn't till everyone thought I was like a quiet, no one could kind of figure out what I did or what I was going to do, until we had that first read through, and that's where, you know, I kind of surprised a bunch of people.
Oh, really?
I got to try some of the things I'd written, and people had cast me in things, and I had a great first read through to the point where people were like, oh, where did he come from? Because he hadn't said a word to any of us. I surprised Lauren to the point where apparently I heard in the meeting where they pitched the sketches that he just kept saying over and over. How good was Will? Like he was even surprised. Like, but there's something about performing, whereas I'm able to always throw away any sort of insecurity that I might have in any sort of social setting. So performing was so much easier than trying to go into everyone's offices and prove that you're funny.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So once you had, once you had it on the stage or whatever, you
then I was good to go.
Just let it go.
Just let it go.
Because you did write a little bit, right? Like, I mean, you did create stuff, whereas some cast members didn't at all.
Right, correct? Right. I mean, that was the whole benefit of having gone through the Groundlings program, where it forced you to write sketches constantly, so you got to use that muscle. So I could kind of navigate my way around writing and writing for myself, so I wasn't at the mercy of. Because sometimes that's where it can be a tough place when you have an idea and you're chasing writers down, like, would you work on this with me? And some writers are up for that, others are like, no, I want to do my special premise, and that can be tough.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that brings up a question, because I started thinking about, you know, you sort of rode the line. You did impersonations, and you also created original characters, and I started thinking about the differences of
I did impersonations of a lot of unnecessary people.
Right. Oh, well, like Harry Carey is a great example. It's not like you're picking someone that's a hot button political person.
Yeah.
But are they similar in a way, or are they total, like, when you decide, like, say Janet Reno?
Right. That's the one I was thinking of.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well. Yeah, yeah. What do you look for in that person to create? Is it physical? Is it like? Is it different with each person?
Yeah, I think it's different. It's usually a physical thing if you can latch onto that and build an impersonation around that. Because I'm not technically gifted the way we mentioned Daryl Hammond, who I would talk to him about the way he would study people, and he could tell that a certain person must have had dental work at some point, because the way their tongue clicks to the roof of their mouth on certain consonants. And you're like, how are you figuring that out? And it's like, oh no, you can just hear if you listen. I was like, oh, I'm not. Because I'm just trying to get the essence.
Right.
And then, and Janet Reno is a case of like, gosh, everyone's trying to land the spotlight political impersonation. Wouldn't it be funny to go against the grain and just do an impersonation of someone? Like, there's no reason. Janet Reno wasn't in the news at all.
Right.
She just had a peculiar look about her, and I was like, wouldn't that be funny? Just have Janet Reno's dance party, and she just hosts like a kid's show. And
it seems like the voice, you grabbed onto the voice.
The voice was the way you think she's going to sound.
Right.
But and she doesn't sound like that at all.
Well, that's the thing about your impersonations. Yeah. Like, yeah. Sometimes it didn't matter.
No, yeah.
Like, I think Alex Trebek was that way, too. Yeah. I don't think he tried to be like him.
No, I tried to do his mannerisms and everything, but I didn't try. I didn't sit up at night listening to tapes constantly.
No, and I think that kind of is part of the appeal for me, too, that, like, okay, I know he's Alex Trebek. Yeah. Now I can enjoy, like, there's more freedom to your impersonations.
And I kind of stole a page out of Dan Aykroyd's playbook and Chevy Chase a little bit, too, because we think about Chevy Chase playing Gerald Ford.
Yeah.
He didn't bother to look like him. He didn't try to sound like him. And yet it was so funny.
Yeah.
Bush was the one guy I really studied only because there was such a spotlight.
Right. He's the president.
On that campaign. And in fact, I didn't even think he was going to. Someone had written a couple Weekend Update monologues.
Right.
And I had done Governor Bush a couple times on the news, but I didn't think he was going to make it through the primaries. And then I saw that he, over the summer, he's picking up steam. I'm like, oh, I better get this guy down. And
that's a weird thing for a liberal to hope the guy gets in the office.
Yeah. I was like, uh-oh, this guy's maybe going to make it to the finish line here. I better start studying him. And he was one of the few times where I really started listening to him and trying to figure that out.
We'll get back to the conversation in a minute, but I wanted to tell you about this new thing called The Blacklist.
From the founders of the ultimate industry screenwriting staple, The Blacklist, comes The Blacklist Table Reads, an exciting new podcast that takes the best screenplays Hollywood hasn't yet made and turns them into movies for your ears. Every month, The Blacklist Table Reads will be turning one script into four weekly episodes, available each Thursday, complete with writer interviews from Blacklist founder Franklin Leonard, a fusion of classic radio theater with the most talked about scripts in Hollywood. It's a very unique listening experience. Their first script is the outrageously satirical comedy Balls Out by Malcolm Spellman, producer of Empire, and Tim Talbot, winner of the 2015 Waldo Salt Screenwriting Award at Sundance, with a cast featuring Paul Scheer, Matt Walsh, Lauren Lapkus, Casey Wilson, and more. So tune into The Blacklist Table Reads, Thursdays on Wolfpop. And now back to the conversation.
One of the things I think that's, you know, very true and very interesting about you is you're just this beloved guy. And you just show up in a movie and people are just ready to like it. You know,
right,
and you have this, you do have that. And I think that it's the kind of thing where I wonder with your success and with how much you've allowed yourself to play with what you do and showing up in guest spots and commercials and everything, how do you find ways to challenge yourself?
It's fun. It's really fun and interesting to me to keep kind of, you know, zigging when people think I'm going to zag, you know.
Right.
It's just, I love every now and then doing those things. I guess it comes from that same instinct of forcing the audience to sit through a bad sketch longer than
right.
they should have
right.
to. But yeah, I just think it's just more dynamic. It adds to the whole body of work in a way to do these random things and it's fun for me. I mean, one of the ideas I had for 5 years, maybe even longer, was to put myself in a Spanish language film.
Right.
And case in point,
Casa de mi Padre,
which there's no reason, you know, professionally speaking, for me to go out on that limb.
I think that stands out as the weirdest moment in your career.
Yeah.
And did you love doing it?
It was. I loved doing it, and yeah, when it was all said and done, I loved doing it. The process was horrible. I was like, how did I get myself into that? Matt Piedmont, our director, was like, he called it a 22-day fever dream. He's like, the fever dream's almost over, okay? Because it was literally, you know, I really only have high school and a little bit of college Spanish.
Right.
So I'm in the car at 5 a.m. driving to set with a translator, going over that day's scene endlessly, going over the scene throughout the shooting day, getting in the car, driving home, and starting on the next day's work. And because the point of the movie wasn't that I spoke Spanish poorly, it would be that wait, is that Will Ferrell? And actually, his Spanish is decent. You
right.
know? And that's kind of the standard I set for myself, even though I know, God, this is going to be hard. This is going to be... But we were ready to go. We had cue cards ready in case I needed them, which I'm happy to say I really didn't go to the cue cards that many times. But if I mispronounced a word, we would do it over again. We'd do it over again until I got, you know, we got enough takes to where the pronunciation was roughly in the ballpark.
But who does that?
I don't know.
That was sort of insane in some ways.
It was insane. And then the marketplace bared out. So as the movie,
it bore out the fact
that no one saw the movie. And it was really hard to sell.
You made a movie that had no demographic audience.
And we thought, because, you know, you hear how Latinos are one of the biggest movie-going segments of the population, and there's not enough there aren't enough Hispanic-focused commercial
right.
movies and things like that. We thought this is a great idea. Put kind of someone from American comedy in the center of one of these. We'll do our take on a telenovela meets a bad, you know, Mexican Western. And but no, sure
no,
enough. Yeah.
No.
We forgot that, oh, it's basically a subtitled movie, and that's not a big... It's still
right.
An art house movie. But I loved... at the end of the day, I loved... That was the most rewarding thing. One of the more rewarding things I'd done.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was... one of the other films I watched that I hadn't seen since it came out in theaters when I was preparing for this was Stranger Than Fiction.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved your performance in that
Thank
film.
You.
And what, you know, for people who don't know, it's a film about a guy who finds out he is a character in a fictional novel.
Correct.
And Harold is his name.
Yeah.
And he's an IRS agent. And you play him with like this strict moral code. And sort of with this simplicity, but that there's a nobility to it, right?
Yeah, totally. That whole job felt like I held my breath the whole time.
How so?
In that I was so afraid to mess it up.
You know, really?
it was one of the more beautiful scripts I've ever read, and it was, you know, because there are moments in Hollywood where there's that script that's being passed around, and they're considering a handful, like eight people, and you read that script, and you're like, oh yeah, of course. Well, this would be amazing, but they're going to go with Russell Crowe, or they're going to go with the bigger name with more international exposure, you know, more the actor and that sort of thing. So I read it going, well, of course this is amazing, but they're not gonna choose me. And and they're like, no, Mark Forster, he's debating whether he wants an actor who's can kind of play off the comedic parts, or if he wants a comedian who can hold his own with the acting. So I sat down with him and we had a great meeting and this and that, and so and I end up getting the part, but I go from, in that movie, I go from acting with Dustin Hoffman to Emma Thompson to Maggie Gyllenhaal, just kind of, you know, I felt like I was on the Harlem Globetrotters, and I was just like, as soon as I got the ball passed to me, I was like, you take it now. Okay, I got it again. No, I'm not going to shoot. No way. And I just was... It was just an amazing, every day of shooting was incredible. And Mark Forster's made some beautiful movies and is really, he's one of those directors that doesn't sit by the monitor. He just sits right, he'll sit Indian style right by the camera or underneath the camera and just watch the scene. And he'll yell back to the DP like, I loved it if it was good for you. Like, he never looked at anything.
Wow.
And there's a scene in the movie where I elicit the help of Dustin Hoffman, who's a literature professor.
Right.
Because I'm trying to figure out what's happening. I'm hearing these voices, and I can't figure out what's going on. And he's kind of my detective I've hired, in a sense, to piece this all together. And we track down this writer, Emma Thompson. He reads her story, and I go to meet with him. I'm like, well, so what's the ver-? And that's the scene where he tells me I have to die. I just have to, which... It's bizarre to talk about in this context, but it's the first time I really had to do an emotional scene with another actor. And here I am with Dustin Hoffman. And that was like, you know, to this day, one of the greatest days as an actor that I will ever have.
I bet.
Yeah.
Now, were you honest with him and said you feel, you know, like, did you share with him that you're feeling like, oh my God, I'm acting with you? Like, how do you manage that?
I don't
know
if I ever actually said those words, but because he was so giving, he was literally, you know, in his off camera, he was like, he wasn't even on camera yet, and he was emoting and helping me to try to get to this place, and all those things you hear about with great actors, and he just made it so comfortable. If anything, I used the fear of not being able to execute it to generate the emotion. I was so afraid that I wouldn't be able to cry that I started crying. And that's what kind of got me to that place, because I didn't want to let anyone down.
Wow.
And so that was, and we had a we had kind of a great moment because, you know, it's weird to do those emotional scenes because you don't know, you don't want to go out of the gate too hard because you don't, you're going to be crying all day. You're like, how much more can I access this?
Right.
And yet you want every moment to be real. So you kind of just, whereas normally on the move, all the other comedies I work in between setups, you're laughing, you're joking, you're like, you're keeping it loose. And I just like sat in a chair. I didn't know what to do with myself. So just kind of sitting and no one wants to, it's like I could tell.
It's like the no hitter.
Exactly. This was the moment in the movie that the producers, the director, everyone who'd cast me didn't know if I could do. And while it was happening, no one wanted to say anything. And it was like a no hitter. No one was talking to me because I think they were just like, oh my gosh, this is going to be a great scene. And like, Will's not effing it up. And, and so Dustin and I have a moment, and which is this is really funny. He was like, he's like he just patted me on the shoulder, like you're doing great. And I'm like, I said, gosh, I wish my dad was here today. He would love this to see the scene, everything like that. And he's like, he grabs me. He's like, when did he pass? And I'm like, oh no, he lives in Irvine. No, I just wish he was just out here 2 weeks ago. No, I just wish he was here right now. He's like, oh, okay. And then he walked away. But I'm just like, no, don't start laughing now. Don't start laughing. So I just didn't know what to expect. Didn't just hoped I would be in the zone for this thing. Am I playing it the right way? Am I going to hate myself on camera? You know, all those things that that you go through when you finally watch the finished thing.
But right. Well, you know, I also read that you on Elf.
Yeah.
When you said you had a moment when you had the pointy shoes and the tights on, where you were like, "Oh my God, my career is over."
Right.
And that made me wonder, with comedy especially, not so much drama, but with comedy especially, if that was you just not being experienced enough yet to know what you had on your hands, or if you never know until you get a film in front of an audience like that. Like, what have you found?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the incident with Elf, it was a combination of things. It's, you know, the headline to all of this is that we truly don't know. It's all an educated guess. And you find it with every movie. The scene that the crew was falling out on the floor about, obviously, I would say more times than not is a scene that doesn't play for the audience,
at least
in my experience. The smaller weird things that you were just doing and then no one noticed, those are the big laughs a lot of times. So you just never know, you know. You truly never know. I'll say that. As it regards to Elf, you know, prior to that point, I was kind of known for a certain style of comedy coming off of Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. I just filmed Old School, which hadn't come out yet. But I think I was known for edgier, provocative kind of
comedy. A little raunchier stuff.
Yeah, or someone who's not afraid to just go for it and not worry about the consequences. So that's why here I am in this Christmas movie. I'm like, am I just going to get killed on this? You know, are people going to just go, wait, what is this premise? What's going on here? And, but it, you know, it all obviously came together in a way that I never would have imagined. Yeah.
It's like truly become a Christmas classic.
And that movie's helped by the fact that it's a Christmas movie. So you're going in, you know, the Christmas tale. For the audience, you're already halfway there. So the idea that a human's raised at the North Pole and grows up without knowing and then is walking around New York in an elf suit and never has a moment of like, oh, I don't belong, or what am I wearing? Because we committed to that and his belief, then that allowed the audience to go, oh no, that's a really funny imaginative premise that works.
See, that's interesting. I think that the audience doesn't consider, or just anybody, you don't consider all the sort of things that go into just buying the premise up front.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And that's probably a hard thing to see when you're on set and making it, because you don't have all the context of it.
Yeah. All those forces put together, I guess, worked in the end. But I had no idea. You know, the first time we tested the movie, we did two screenings. We did one that was more of a family-focused audience. And it worked great with them. And then my manager, Jimmy, called me. He's like, hey, so we just had the first one. It went really well. But I'm looking at the crowd lineup for the second screening, and it's like a bunch of frat guys from USC. And we might get eviscerated in this. And but it played for that audience, too. So then we thought, then it was, that's when we knew, oh, well, this could... Maybe this will work as one of those rare movies that works for everyone, and you throw your cynicism aside, and it's heartwarming, but it's also funnier than you think it's going to be, and so.
And that's what happened.
And that's what happened.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That collaborative thing, you know, when you're in the middle of it, it really is amazing when it works, you know. You've mentioned Adam McKay a couple times, and I've always kind of dreamed of that perfect collaboration thing. And I'm a solo guy. Like, I'm a photographer, I'm a director.
Right.
I don't get to have that collaboration that often. And I just wonder if he is like, you know, not only, obviously, I'm sure your relationship has grown and changed and you have your working methods, but as you become, you know, more and more experienced and famous and successful, does he remain sort of your bullshit detector in terms of, you know, an audience where you feel like you can always throw something by him and know you're going to get an honest answer? I mean, what is his value to you as a collaborator?
I mean, I think it's everything you just said. You know, it's just that unique thing where, you know, Adam and I were literally hired on Saturday Night Live on the same day.
Oh, really?
And in fact, he was coming out of the office, Lauren's office, as I was waiting in his lobby to go in next. And we didn't know each other, obviously, at that time. But when we met at the show and started working together, it was just, it's hard to explain because... I think it rarely happens, and it's just a shared language. It's a shared. We just had a shorthand with each other where
right off the bat,
okay. Yeah. Where he, you know, technically speaking, we both liked to write sketches quickly and not overthink it, and just have fun and just kind of not turn it into such a chore, and that kind of just turned into writing features, and it's, you know, it happens today. We'll both be on a conference call where we're just even acting as producers on something, and someone will bring up a point, and I'll start to articulate something, and Adam goes, "I know exactly what Will's about to say. I think what we need to do is A, B, C, and D," and I'm like, that's exactly what I was going to say. And we just share the same comedy brain is the best way I can describe it. And he'll come, and I'll have a thing, and he'll add three other levels to it that I didn't even think of, which will then have me go to another place. Then he'll go, oh, that's hilarious. Then he'll add another thing. And so we end up just building this treehouse with everything we do, where we don't know the shape of, we never have a blueprint. You know, we'll have a rough outline, but we don't know what the treehouse is going to look like. And then when we step back, we're like, boy, that looks pretty good. Or that's a crazy looking treehouse, but it's going to be fun to climb in. It may break apart in 2 seconds, but we're going to have a great time playing in that for a while, you know.
So is a lot of it vocal? Like, will you guys throw things back and forth, or is it writing? Or
it's both. You know, if it's on the set, it'll Adam kind of developed this thing now on when we did Anchorman 2, where he'd sit with a wireless mic behind the monitor and put a speaker in the on the set. And just as the cameras roll, he just is writing in his head and just coming up with extra lines while we just stay in the flow of the scene. And then that will trigger ideas that I have. And it's kind of, it's been a huge gift for me especially. I mean, for both of us, I think we both view it as like kind of one of the more amazing things that have happened to each other in our lives.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right.
We also shared, you know, when we sat down to write Anchorman, we wrote this movie that kind of in our heads, at least, broke all the rules of all these other movies we've been watching. And we kept saying, well, why? You know, but I'd love to see a movie do this. And I'd love to go back to kind of the ensemble comedy. Because prior to that, you know, a lot of the movies you'd see, a Jim Carrey movie, had the central funny character that would drive the story.
Right.
And everyone reacts off of it. And we're the kids who grew up on Animal House and Stripes and all these ensemble pieces that
Caddyshack
and we just had this nostalgic thing. It wouldn't be fun to return back to, you know, I love being the funny character, but I also love seeing everyone else get laughs, and it also takes the pressure off the main character. It's great to have an exit and enter the film later. To cut to other funny parts of the movie, other funny characters, other funny storylines. And we really, you know, that movie kind of set the tone for how we were going to work. And we always had this thing with all the projects we've worked on is like, what if I'm sitting in a theater and I paid my $13 or $15 or what is it now? $19.75?
Yeah, I think it's $27.
$27. And I saw these eight things in a movie, I would walk out going, that was worth my money.
Yeah.
So we're always trying to, on the projects we work on, just think of those things that, oh, I have never seen that before. And so that's been the backbone of our creative relationship.
Well, on that note too, I think that one of the most true things I've heard about your style of comedy is in a story you related where you were in some studio executive meeting and some executive said, the main thing about a comedic lead is that he has to be likable. Right. And you just said right there, it's absolutely wrong. And you've gone on really to prove that. I mean, you really, when you think about Ron Burgundy, he's essentially an unlikable dude that somehow audiences love. So, I mean, is that that sort of like, I mean, you know, when you talk about breaking rules, like there really maybe aren't any rules. As long as the guy has a goal, something to do,
then
he can be anything. And I think that's what's amazing. And maybe it you know, speaks to the fact that you're so likable that you can do these characters. And
yeah, I mean, I think it helps. It's helped me that I'm this guy who seems like could be your neighbor or your work colleague. And
or your valet.
Or your valet. Or your bank teller. Or your switchboard operator at an art auction house. And yet the most outlandish things come out of my mouth. And it's kind of this contrast that's obviously worked for me. It's true. We would bristle against the fact that Because you meet a lot of comedy writers and it'll be like, well, I don't know, in the second act, this needs to happen. I'm like, no, it doesn't. No one's walked out of a comedy going, did you see that plot shift in the second act? Wasn't that nice? No, you're walking out going, oh my God, when he played jazz flute or, you know, when Ricky Bobby was mauled by a cougar for no reason.
For no
There's
reason
no
at all.
Yeah.
That's right.
You're remembering the jokes. You're remembering the funny, the moments that you can't believe you just saw in a comedy. I think we've tried to shatter all those things.
Well, I think that if I've taken away anything from this, it's that, you know, maybe not working so hard is the way to go. It doesn't have to be a chore. If you just want to get a cougar and have him maul somebody, maybe that's all you have to do.
I mean, it's still agonizing, though. Believe me, there are times, we left that part out
of course.
Interview that
of course
there are moments where we're at the key where, you know, you're writing something and you're just like, I don't know how to make this work.
Right.
Yeah.
I think when you say Stripes and you say Caddyshack and you say Animal House, it puts it in perspective of, you know, if you forget how to have fun with it, then that's the first step towards disaster, right? And it seems like,
and everyone's always shocked, like, how's it gonna be? How's the movie gonna be? Oh, I don't know. I have no idea. You don't? I literally don't know. It could, and I love telling people, it could be great or it could be horrible. We just don't know. And then I pat them on the back and then I walk away. And they're now, you know, but you have to let that go and just let the process and trust the fact that, you know, your educated guess, because comedy, that's all it is an educated guess. Your educated guess is probably closer than someone else's, and it's probably going to land on its feet.
Right, right. Well, I mean, comedy's the weirdest thing anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, just if you start thinking about it too hard, then nothing works.
Nothing works, and it's terrible. Yeah.
Well, I could talk to you all day, and I've enjoyed not only this conversation, but just getting to know you over
Thank
the years.
Thank you, Sam. Yeah, you too.
No,
yeah.
It's great. And I hope, you know, and we'll do a part two at some point.
And congrats on the show. It's so, you know, it's just really refreshing to see a conversation.
Oh, thank you.
In this era of sound bites.
Exactly, right?
This age of sound bites. So that's why this is all. I hope the show goes on for 50 years.
One show or the show in
this,
general?
No, this show right here.
This show right here, 50
goes
years.
In the time.
Well, we can keep going.
The time capsule.
Thank you for coming on.
Thanks,
Sam.
I
appreciate it. And please, anytime you feel like
espousing on any subject,
just espouse here.
Just knock on the door.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're always here.
The cameras are always going. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
So that's our show. I really hope you enjoyed it. And if you want to take part in the entire off-camera experience, you have to go to offcamera.com. You can get the app. You can watch full HD versions of our television show. You can subscribe to this podcast and hear from all of our guests. And we even make an exclusive magazine, which has a bunch of photographs and things that you won't find anywhere else. It really is an interactive experience that we put a lot of work into, so take some time and check it out at offcamera.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Sam Jones. And if you want to check out my photography and directing work, you can go to samjonespictures.com. There's some fun stuff there to check out. And I love hearing from listeners. So if you feel like dropping me a line and commenting on the show, send me an email. I'm at sam@offcamera.com. And make sure to listen next time when I sit down with actor Ethan Hawke, who I found utterly fascinating. He is a restless artist who is fearless and curious and is always diving into new pursuits. I hope you'll find our conversation as fascinating as I did. Until next time, I'm Sam Jones signing off. Thanks for listening.